Hi, Marco Werman here with a quick word before the show. We just wrapped up our spring fundraiser and wanted to say thank you. Thank you to each of the 210 listeners who answered our call in the last few weeks and donated. We so appreciate you, not just your financial support, but also the messages you shared with us. Like this one from Keith, a listener who tunes in from Washington, D.C. Thank you for the excellent reporting day to day. You always ask the questions I want to ask. And you make reporting around the world look easy, and I know it's far from it. Well, Keith, it's a little easier knowing that we have a community of listeners invested in our work. So thank you, all of you, once again. And now, the show. Boris Johnson is facing another political scandal, and this one just might bring down the British Prime Minister.
It's really, I think, obvious that he's beginning to just bleed out.
Even Johnson's own cabinet ministers are jumping ship. And in China, a hacker claims to have pulled off what might be the biggest data theft ever, anywhere.
It will become a new era that we feel like maybe a lot of our information is already out there, so how can we protect ourselves?
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, Sudan's military coup leaders say they will hand over political power to civilians, but nobody seems to believe them.
There is no way that anyone, whether it's the political parties or the resistance committees or any other factions, that they would believe what the army is saying.
And a Canadian mountain named after a Nazi collaborator? That's going to change today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Boris Johnson is a survivor, but has the UK Prime Minister finally used up all nine of his political lives? After the latest chapter of scandal this week, two high-profile Conservative Party members quit Johnson's cabinet, including Health Secretary Sajid Javid.
But I do fear that the reset button can only work so many times. There's only so many times you can turn that machine on and off before you realise that something is fundamentally wrong.
Further down the political ranks, more resignations followed. By dinner time, at least 34 ministers and aides had quit. They resigned in protest over Johnson defending his decision to hire a government official with a long history of sexual misconduct. A parliamentary session today ended with a group of MPs wishing the Prime Minister a sarcastic farewell. So is this the tipping point for Boris Johnson? I'm joined by Tim Bale, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University of London. Tim, where are we at this point in the Prime Minister's political career? Is it the end, the beginning of the end?
I think it's certainly the beginning of the end, and we could even see him go by the end of this week. It's very clear that today his problems have only got worse rather than better. Right now, he has people resigning left, right and centre. He has MPs who aren't members of the government writing letters to him saying that they have no confidence in him anymore. And it's really, I think, obvious that he's beginning to just bleed out.
I mean, we've heard several times over the past 6 months that it's the end. Johnson was infamously embroiled in scandal for hosting parties during the pandemic. But why are Conservatives finally jumping ship now?
Well, I think it is partly to do with this case in particular. I think the fact that it involves sexual misconduct, it has become very clear that Boris Johnson lied to people about whether he knew about the allegations of misconduct, has really spooked some MPs who were prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt on what they considered were more minor issues, if you like. It's also obviously that they can read the opinion polls, which look very dire for them at the moment. And they've also suffered a couple of bad by-election defeats in the last couple of weeks. So I think it's a concatenation of circumstances. It's this particular case, but it's also the fact that they are reading the writing on the wall electorally and thinking this guy is now a big liability and no longer an asset.
These scandals do seem to take all the oxygen out of the room while they're happening. What is not getting done politically while the whole government is focused on Johnson's latest scandal?
Well, I mean, we have a severe economic crisis in this country at the moment, particularly with regard to inflation and the so-called cost of living. People's incomes are really, really squeezed. And there are many people who feel that the government could and should be doing more and feel that the government is taking its eye off the ball because it's so concerned with trying to defend Boris Johnson.
Boris Johnson recently survived a no-confidence vote. But as the health secretary said earlier, they can hit the reset button only so many times. So how secure is his position?
Quite frankly, if Boris Johnson refuses to resign himself, there will be a second confidence vote, and it will come possibly even in the next few days. And Boris Johnson will lose that vote. And then we will have a very interesting situation, because if he still refuses to step down, that brings the Queen into the picture. The Queen is the person who appoints the Prime Minister. The Queen is also the person who, in extremis, could sack the Prime Minister.
So what's the likely scenario you anticipate this week, Tim?
Well, I think the likely scenario is that there will be such pressure on Johnson that in the end, even he gives up. And if he doesn't, I think his party will no confidence him and will try and force him out that way. And as I say, if he won't leave Downing Street, I think it will be up to the palace, to the sovereign, to tell him to go. And I don't even think Boris Johnson would refuse a request from the Queen to step down.
Pretty extraordinary times. Tim Bale is a professor of politics at Queen Mary University of London. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
An anonymous hacker named China Dan is offering up information on as many as 1 billion Chinese citizens. The price tag for the alleged trove is $200,000. If confirmed, this would be one of the largest data breaches in China. In fact, it would also be one of the biggest data hacks anywhere. Ziyi Yang is a China reporter with MIT Technology Review. He's looked at some of the data involved here and joins us now from New York. What do we know so far about this digital information? What's in it?
So the hacker has released a sample data set, and among those data sets are people's addresses, crime records, police call records. This is a lot of information that only something like a Chinese government would get from you. Like, we know that a lot of companies out there are collecting our information. That's the same in China. A lot of tech companies, consumer companies, they are collecting information. But there are also things that only the Chinese government or the police would have, like your police calls, your unique identity number, which is similar to the social security we have here.
How significant is this breach?
Well, it's very big. First of all, China has about 1.4 billion people, so this covers over half of China, which is a lot. And also, according to the information we have right now, like the sample data sets that the hacker released, this information are quite authentic, actually. Like, people can verify the numbers with their names, with their addresses. And so if this whole data set is completely authentic, this will be probably the most historically significant data break.
So what would it mean if data of even a fraction of these 1 billion people was acquired by someone for the price tag of $200,000? What would they actually do with it?
Right. So one thing we need to be clear about this is that it's not about kind of like hacking into your personal account and doing things with your account or your credit card information. It's more about having your information and then using it most likely in telecommunication fraud, because in China, telecommunication fraud is pretty prevalent. And there has already been cases where people buy personal information and use that to trick you into giving out more of information. So this is right now the biggest concern, is that if a crime organization can afford this 1 billion nationals information, they can basically use that to have their own database and use that to trick people, to scam people.
How is this story being reported in China, and what are people saying about it?
Well, right now, we are suspecting that the Chinese government has forbid people from talking about it. We are seeing some of like the social media censors. They're being working to scrub these conversations. And that's not very surprising, because it does paint the government in a bad picture. And usually the government avoids those kind of conversations online. But right now, we have not seen any kind of accountability responses. We have not seen how the government addresses it or going to guard this information better in the future. None of those yet.
So what are the implications of this data breach for cybersecurity in China?
I think it does start a new conversation about government responsibility in securing these databases. There has been a lot of conversation about how private companies collect too much information and don't store them securely. That's something people are already worried about, and people are already asking for more accountability. But so far, discussions about how the government stores the data has kind of assumed that the government has the resource and has the technology to secure them very well. But this data break just shows us that that's actually not always the case. Because like all of this data are managed by local governments, they may not have the best security practice to make sure that citizen data cannot leak to the public.
We've been speaking with Ziyi Yang. He's a China reporter for the MIT Technology Review. He joined us from New York. Ziyi, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
The pandemic ushered in an era of working from home. It certainly has its perks, but working remotely can also be a curse, like when procrastination sets in. Tasanka Sirapala has this story from Tokyo about a place that helps people stay focused.
At this cafe, there are no excuses for missing a deadline. This self-declared anti-procrastination cafe only accepts customers who are struggling to write. The cafe is located on a busy intersection, but there's no barista, tea, or food. There's snacks, or the manager says you can just head to the convenience store across the street. Takuya Kawai launched the cafe in April. He's developed an unusual hourly monitoring system for customers and promises not to let them leave without completing their goal. According to Mr. Kawai, there is no such thing as the perfect writer. I think no writer can always 100% make a deadline, he says. People are always looking for ways to extend them. Already, more than 500 customers have passed through the space in search of a procrastination antidote. The strictest rule we have is that when you come into the cafe, you need to write down the goal you want to achieve, Mr. Kawai says. If you are not able to finish it, you will need to stay back until it's done. Mr. Kawai sips on a stainless steel thermos from a straw and carries around his tiny one-year-old Datsun Chihuahua. He explains that customers can choose from a mild, normal, or severe hourly caution. The mild caution is for people who can concentrate and don't need any check-ins. Normal is an hourly check-in where I stand behind them and ask them for progress, he says. Severe is where I stand behind them and peek at their computers. I don't look intricately at what they're writing, but people are so engrossed in their work or they have their headphones in that they don't even notice me. When you read the rules on the website, they seem really rigid, but Mr. Kawai's anti-procrastination strategy is actually far more nurturing. During the hourly check-ins, I ask people how much they've completed, which the guest usually replies with half or one-third, and I reward them with candy or sweets. Many customers here come to get away from the distractions of their home, their kids, their pets, or the refrigerator. Now, I had to come try the anti-procrastination cafe myself, and I have to say that I found the environment a little bit distracting. The abrasive sound of express trains, constant traffic, and a tiny chihuahua running in between my legs puts me on edge. I chose the severe caution option to write the script to this story. At one point, Mr. Kawai holds a sign asking me how my progress is. Another time, he peers at my screen from behind, which adds to the anxiety. Mr. Kawai says that his aim is to help guests concentrate rather than to scold. It is kind of a game that we play with customers. You need to follow the rules and finish the task to the end. If you say you've finished when you haven't, that doesn't serve you any purpose. I'm not the person who's commissioned the piece. The cafe has attracted a cult following. Corky is at the cafe building a website. It's his seventh trip. He tells me it's not only that he can concentrate better, it's the way Mr. Kawai manages everyone's progress. It is not like at high school where teachers are strict and tell you what to do, he says. It doesn't feel like a place where things are mandatory. It's a concept where the manager works with the customer to guide you to do your work in a good environment. Maju is also a regular who's working on a novel in her spare time. The price is quite reasonable. It's so easy to use, she says. I come here at least once a week. I'm very grateful that he asks about my progress. It gives me a change of pace and we also exchange words. That's what makes this place different from other cafes. There's nothing special about the cafe's location or facilities. The cafe's charm is its ability to bring out the psychology of intention, something that we all have inside. For The World, I'm Tasanka Sirapala in Tokyo.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Military leaders in Sudan have maintained tight control over the government there ever since a coup late last year. But this week, coup leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan said he would support a full transition back to civilian rule in Sudan. The offer was promptly rejected by the political opposition. To find out why, we're joined by Dalia Abdel-Monaim. She's a Sudanese activist and joins us from the capital, Khartoum. Dalia, why was the opposition so quick to reject the Sudanese military's offer of civilian rule?
Because we don't trust, nor do we believe the military. Everything they've promised or they said they would do, they basically haven't. I mean, we're in the current, you know, turmoil that we're in, political turmoil, because of them, because of the coup that they undertook back in October. So there is no way that anyone, whether it's the political parties or the resistance committees or any other factions, that they would believe what the army is saying. Not only that, he also said that they would establish a superior military council, which would be, he didn't quite specify what the powers would be, but that mainly they'd be in charge of the security and defense of the country. You can't even defend us. You're killing us. So how can you defend the country? So basically, we do not trust the military.
Well, today I see that Burhan relieved five civilian members of the Sovereign Council from their duties. I mean, does that suggest that he might be ready to let civilians just form their own council and lead the way?
The civilians were just like, you know, puppets. They really had no power. They had no say. They were originally part of the original civilian government under Prime Minister Hamdok. They were there merely, in my opinion, they were merely there for decoration, as in, look, I have civilians in my government. If the military is serious about handing power to the civilian, they keep postponing and they keep halting all the talks that have been held. They keep promising one thing and then doing another. Every time there's been a protest, the protests have been met with, you know, the military might of all the factions, of all the armed groups. You know, we've been protesting since October. That's only 8 months now, and more than 100 civilians, most of whom are like in their early 20s, early, you know, late teens, have been killed, including something like 15 children.
So pro-democracy protests have continued in Sudan. I mean, just last week, protests by many activists led to violence. People were killed. I'd like to know what the opposition's strategy is right now for transitioning to a civilian-led government at the same time as Burhan saying that's what his goal is. I mean, what are the demands of protesters?
The protests are basically saying the military goes back to what it's supposed to do, which is to act as the army to protect the country, but not to have any role in governance. I mean, Sudan has been ruled by the military for more than 30 years. So the history, you know, history teaches us a lot. And it tells us a lot about, especially the Sudanese military. So in ours, from what we're saying, is like they should have no role in any government. It should be purely civilian. And there's a chant, there's a very common chant that they keep saying during the protests, go back to the barracks. The army, the military should go back to the barracks, which is what they should be doing. But of course, the military, because they have a lot of economic interests, it's not in their best interest to loosen the grip that they have on the government and to move back. So how does that play out? I don't know, because it's very hard for them to relinquish power. And at the same time, the opposition is refusing to negotiate or for them to have any role in any future government. I mean, we as people have been demanding a purely civilian transitional government.
And right now, things appear to be at a standstill in Sudan. Do you see a way for both sides to work together to restore democracy in Sudan and get the military back to the barracks?
It's one of the tactics that can be used is basically a general strike, cripple the country economically. And I think that can force the military to basically understand, okay, we need to do something. Like I've said, the protests haven't stopped. You know, they've been sit-ins ever since the last protest on the 30th of June. There have been sit-ins throughout this country. Thousands of people, they've just basically blocked spaces and they've just sat there. And we're going into a period of a national holiday, so the country's going to come to a standstill. Economically, it's in ruins. The currency is, you know, has lost its value. So something has to give, and that giving has to come from the military side because it's on them. They hold, you know, they need to understand for the country to move forward, they need to step back.
Well, it's true. People Power was behind the uprising that toppled former dictator Omar al-Bashir. But since then, 3 years ago, a military coup, these violent crackdowns on protests, and now this stalemate. How would you describe the state of things right now for the Sudanese people?
Well, in terms of optimism, I mean, they haven't let up. I mean, every time I go out in a protest, I'm in awe because the numbers never decrease. They're always out there. It's the same passion. It's the same, you know, belief that they deserve better and that they are, that they should get better than what they already have. So that's one of the things that keeps me going, that keeps me optimistic, because, you know, I'm like, OK, we're in good hands, because, you know, the majority of the people, whether they're old or young or whatever, they know it's in our best interest to have a civilian-led government.
Dalia Abdel-Munaim is a Sudanese activist and resident of Khartoum, where she joined us from. Dalia, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco. Thank you for having me.
It is a classic dad move to quiz your kids about songs on the radio or towns you pass through on the highway. But for one family in Calgary, those little quizzes led to a lasting legacy. It all started a few decades ago when Jeffrey Taylor took his kids hiking in Canada's Rocky Mountains. He'd pepper them with questions about whom each peak was named after. Son Duncan Taylor told the CBC he remembers them well.
A lot of the mountains have World War I themes, so there's a bunch that are named after ships that took place in the Battle of Jutlands. And then there's ones named after battles. And then there's ones that are named after generals.
And one of those in particular stood out to the Taylor family, Mount Pétain. It's named after French General Henri-Philippe Pétain. He was a hero during World War I, but during World War II, he worked closely with the Nazis as chief of state for the pro-German Vichy government in France.
And he sent a congratulatory letter to the German army congratulating them for killing hundreds of Canadian soldiers. You know, no amount of good, no amount of heroics in the First World War can make up for that.
Still, the Canadian mountain was named after the general, despite Pétain's later conviction of treason. A nearby glacier and creek were also dubbed Pétain. This did not sit well with the Taylor family when they hiked the region, so in 2016, father and son asked Alberta's government to change the mountain's name. In 2019, Alberta said yes, they'd rescind the name of the Nazi collaborator. But the fight was not over, because Mount Pétain straddles two provinces, Alberta and British Columbia. Sadly, son Duncan Taylor had to make the appeal to BC by himself.
My dad unfortunately passed away in 2020, so after that happened, I kind of wanted to finish the job.
And he did. Last week, BC's Ministry of Tourism, Arts, Culture and Sport officially rescinded the Pétain name from the mountain, glacier and creek. The ministry told the world that the proposal to change the names received strong community support. Duncan Taylor told the CBC his family still hikes the region and his dad would be relieved their legacy project was finally complete.
Whenever we go, we can look at the map and we can look up at the skyline and know that, yeah, the map's changed because of his passion.
The new name for the mountain is still up in the air. Both Alberta and BC say they'll work with local stakeholders to find a new one. As for you dads, keep quizzing your kids on interesting things. Something will stick. They fled the war in their nation of Georgia back in the 1990s. Some of them found shelter in the ruins of abandoned Soviet-era palaces. One resident says, true, there are no comforts here, but all the same, I'm used to it. For three decades, these places were called home. That's still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. During the pandemic, the gap between rich and poor in Latin America became even wider. But now some big political changes are playing out as a result. Latin American voters are choosing politicians on the left, candidates who've promised to raise taxes and spend that money on anti-poverty programs. The latest country to pivot to the left is Colombia, a close U.S. ally that held its presidential election last month. Manuel Rueda has more from Bogota.
Gustavo Petro Isoli, su presidente.
In a packed stadium, thousands of people cheered Gustavo Petro as he gave his victory speech. The senator had just won Colombia's presidential election and said he had big plans for the country.
Es el gobierno que quiere construir a Colombia como una potencia mundial de la vida.
We will turn Colombia into a global powerhouse for life, he said. We will have peace, social justice, and environmental justice. Petro was once a member of a rebel group. And he's among a growing number of leftist politicians who are now winning elections in Latin America, after years of losing to parties on the center and the right, In Peru, union leader Pedro Castillo won that nation's presidential contest last year, while in Chile, voters elected former student leader Gabriel Boric in December's presidential election, and also approved a plan to rewrite the country's constitution. This is happening after years of frustration with social and economic inequalities throughout the region, says James Bosworth, a political risk consultant in Bogotá.
And so you saw this wave of protests hit in 2019. They hit in Ecuador, hit in Peru, and in Bolivia. You had the protests in Chile, protests in Colombia. It was people expressing anger at their political leaders for not having managed to grow the societies and brought the benefits of economic development.
As the pandemic made problems like unemployment and poverty worse, voters have been eager to turn to politicians who are offering big changes.
You know, you have this moment where people are looking for new politicians, new parties that might be able to succeed where the previous parties failed, and these outsiders have come in and won.
In Colombia, Petro says he wants to boost the nation's tax collection by around 20% this year in order to spend more money on anti-poverty programs. While in Chile, legislators are rewriting the constitution with clauses that guarantee free access to health care and education.
People felt that they weren't getting the benefits of Chile's economic boom. They didn't get the benefits of education, health care. They weren't happy with the pension system. People really did want reforms in Chile.
Latin America's shift towards the left will have some significant consequences for the United States. That's especially true with issues like trade and drug policy, where the newly elected presidents tend to be less aligned with the U.S. In Colombia, which is the world's largest cocaine producer, President-elect Petro has been a critic of some U.S.-backed anti-drug policies.
He will not do some of the traditional things that the United States has insisted on, like meeting very high coca eradication targets involving, you know, eradicating farm families' coca without providing any other way for them to make a living. He's not going to do that.
Adam Isaacson is a defense policy expert at WOLA, a human rights group based in Washington.
I think they could have a very good conversation about how to get government and how to get the justice system into all of these ungoverned areas. But the United States always does tend to believe there's a large military and police component to that. They think you can't govern your territory without really, you know, having a really good security perimeter. And I think that's where the negotiations will really be most intense.
The U.S. can expect intense negotiations around some other issues as well. For instance, how to deal with broke states like Venezuela and Nicaragua. Before the pandemic, Chile, Colombia, and Peru joined the United States in efforts to force Venezuela into holding democratic elections. They imposed economic sanctions and tried to isolate the country. But now, the new leaders of these South American countries are reestablishing diplomatic ties with Venezuela, saying that the sanctions haven't worked, and adding that they don't want to get involved in another country's domestic problems.
It is a changing dynamic in Latin America. There's no question about it.
Eric Farnsworth is the vice president of the Council of the Americas, an organization that works to bolster ties between the U.S. and Latin America. He says that while the U.S. has lost leverage on some issues, it could focus on working with governments in the region to tackle other common problems, like developing sources of clean energy.
You know, for example, Argentina is sitting on a huge amount of natural gas that could be more effectively developed as a way to help ease the energy crunch in Europe that is currently facing energy scarcity because of what's going on with Russia.
Other issues that the U.S. and its Latin American neighbors could work on include schemes to slow down deforestation in the Amazon and programs to combat tax evasion and corruption. The important thing, Farnsworth says, is for diplomats in Latin America and the U.S. to be creative and to be tolerant of their ideological differences. For the World, I'm Manuel Rueda, in Bogotá.
Ukrainian officials have been constant with one message. They need more high-tech weapons to fight Russian invaders. President Volodymyr Zelensky made the case in April.
Freedom must be armed better than tyranny. Western countries have everything to make it happen. The final victory over the tyranny and the number of people saved depends on them. Arm Ukraine now to defend freedom.
Zelensky has made that same pitch to European leaders, to the U.S. Congress, also directly to President Joe Biden. But there are other less public ways that Ukraine is trying to enlist help. Like many countries, Ukraine hires lobbyists in Washington, a lot of them. A total of 24 firms or individuals are registered to lobby on behalf of Ukrainian clients. That's according to Vox.com. We asked Ben Freeman to put this in perspective. His book is The Foreign Policy Auction. Freeman is now a research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft.
It's really extraordinary right now what we're seeing in terms of lobbying on behalf of Ukraine. And in fact, even before the war began, the Ukraine lobby was perhaps the most active lobby that I've ever investigated. And I've been looking at this issue for almost 15 years now. Before the war, last year, for example, the Ukrainian lobby contacted more than 13,000 lawmakers, press folks, and think tankers. Since the war began, they've only gotten even more robust in their efforts.
So who exactly are these lobbyists? How do they do their work?
Typically, when we're talking about lobbyists for foreign governments, we're very often talking about former members of Congress, former congressional staff, former high-ranking government officials, and sometimes even high-ranking military officials as well. And with the Ukraine lobby, we're really seeing all of these interests come together. It's the folks who have the connections on the Hill and in the administration that are able to get the things done for their foreign clients.
I mean, Ukraine's president already has easy access to America's commander-in-chief. It seems that every turn, Zelensky asked Joe Biden for weapons. What more can lobbyists actually add to that?
I think, frankly, right now, Zelensky is the very best lobbyist in Washington. He's incredibly charismatic, and he's got, you know, widespread support in the U.S. for helping his country. I think what the paid lobbyists bring to the table, it's really on the margins, and it's doing kind of the nitty-gritty work behind the scenes where Zelensky might make a big ask of President Biden. Where the lobbyists come in is they cross the T's, they dot the I's on these big arms sales packages, and they're really successful. They've gotten billions and billions of dollars in military and economic support for Ukraine already, with probably more on the way.
So we know the money that sloshes around in the lobbying community in Washington. Are these people lobbying on behalf of Ukraine going beyond asking for help? I mean, you know about the wining and dining in five-star Washington hotels. Is there an opportunistic approach they're taking in this moment?
What we're seeing from the Ukraine lobby right now is I think you have this stable of lobbying and PR firms who are already working for Ukrainian interests before the war broke out, and they're by and large paid. What we've seen since the war broke out is really a rash of pro bono work for Ukrainian interests, you know, big lobbying firms in some cases that aren't charging a dime to represent Ukrainian interests. And they're throwing big fancy dinners, where we're hearing, and, you know, really spending money out of their own pocket to help these Ukrainian interests. You know, there's no such thing as a free lunch in D.C., Marco. And so what I think we're seeing is that these firms are investing in their own good PR. There's a reputational boost for these companies to be seen as siding with Ukrainian interests right now. And they might have very much altruistic motives to begin with, but they're definitely getting some reputational goodwill that could help them down the line, possibly secure them other profitable contracts with firms down the road.
Is that PR boost guaranteed? I mean, I read that some of these lobbyists have actually also worked for Russia.
Right. This is a really fascinating thing we've seen lately. We have some of these firms who were previously working on behalf of Russian oligarchs and Russian banks, and they've now completely switched sides in this lobbying fight, and they're working for Ukrainian interests now. And in some cases, they're working for Ukrainian interests totally for free.
Ben, you've been describing a situation with lobbyists for Ukraine and Washington that feels kind of wild and off the leash. What concerns you about this lobbying bonanza for Ukraine right now?
Most folks in the American public, you know, might agree with what these lobbyists are pushing for. But we still need transparency about the work that's going on here. And I think what we're seeing is that a lot of this pro bono work that's being done, folks aren't registering for the work that they're doing. They're not being transparent about everything they're doing for their Ukrainian clients, or in some cases, they're registering late. And so we only find out about this stuff after the fact. So I think when we're talking about foreign lobbying, whether we're talking about a good guy, a bad guy, or an ugly guy, regardless of what we think of this country and its lobbyists, we need to have transparency about the work that they're doing.
Ben Freeman is author of The Foreign Policy Auction and a research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, speaking with us about the lobbying effort in Washington on behalf of Ukraine. Ben, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Marco.
We have never seen so much human displacement in history. Right now, across the globe, more than 100 million people have been driven out of their homes. A lot of them spend time living in refugee camps, but many also flee to urban areas where they find longer-term shelter and start new lives. Some people who escaped the fighting in the nation of Georgia 30 years ago, that was during the war in the Abkhazia region, they ended up in a Soviet-era spa town in the west-central part of the country. The abandoned resorts, often known as sanatoriums, have been their residences ever since. From Georgia, Levi Bridges reports.
One of the most impressive sanatoriums in the town of Skeltdubo is this big neoclassical building. Inside, tall marble columns rise before a sparkling chandelier. This place was abandoned in the 90s. Some rooms are totally trashed. There's a bunch of wood and old books and broken glass everywhere. It's starting to get dark, and to say that it feels like the scene of a horror film is almost kind of an understatement. But somehow it doesn't feel scary. There are 22 decrepit sanatoriums in Skeltubo. They kind of feel like old hotels. During the Soviet Union, people came here to bathe in the town's mineral springs, which were renowned for their healing properties. When the Soviet Union collapsed, the state-owned sanatoriums were shuttered. But then, starting in 1992, a huge wave of people fled a war in Georgia's breakaway region of Abkhazia. Thousands ended up in the sanatoriums.
Hello.
Hello. As I wander around the dark hallways, I run into some of the people who still live here. 40-year-old Lika Haribaba invites me to coffee in a room she shares with her mom. There's two beds and a little stove crackling away that they use for cooking. Lika Haribaba fled Abkhazia during the war when the region tried to separate from Georgia. The conflict has never really been resolved. Abkhazia declared itself independent, and Russian troops are now stationed there. Sitting in her room, Haribaba shows me a TV report from the 90s where the separatists are fighting on the street she grew up on. Separatists killed ethnic Georgians like her family, Haribaba says. She calls it genocide. Haribaba tells me people in Abkhazia had it even worse than Ukrainians, because back then, they didn't have the internet to show the world what was happening. When Haribaba moved to this sanatorium, there was no electricity, no water. Now there are hoses and power lines snaking out the windows. Haribaba has really fond memories growing up here, playing with the other kids. She really loves this sanatorium, and that's the way lots of Georgians feel about these buildings. In the center of Skeltdubo, I meet 72-year-old Anzor Babunashvili, a civil engineer who worked at the sanatoriums during the Soviet days. He says seeing these sanatoriums in ruins makes him cry sometimes. Especially for older Georgians, sanatoriums are a reminder of how Georgia was considered by some as the pearl of the Soviet Union. David Sichinava is a geographer at Carleton University in Ottawa. He was also displaced from Abkhazia during the war and grew up in Skeltdubo himself. He says sanatoriums first started in Central Europe, places like Germany, and then the tradition spread to Russia.
It was actually a very popular pastime in late 19th century, early 20th century.
It seems that like in every Russian novel, there's a character who has just come from a sanatorium or is about to go to a sanatorium.
Yeah. But when Bolsheviks took over in the Soviet Union, the sanatoria changed to serve, let's say, broader masses, not just kind of wealthy people. At least that was the idea.
With a large grant from the World Bank, the Georgian government plans to renovate Skeltubo's sanatoriums to spur tourism. Most of the people living in the buildings have been moved into new housing constructed by the government.
As the town rebrands itself from a rundown refuge back to its original glory as a spa resort, Cichinava worries the residents will be written out of recent history.
The stories of about 10,000 people who used to live there, make their life in Skaltugo, and now are almost being erased.
On one of their last nights in the sanatorium, Lika Hadabava and her mother sing songs by the wood fire. They have a brand new apartment already waiting for them, but Hadabava isn't ready to leave. I'll admit, this place isn't comfortable, but I got used to it, she says. It's home. The town is already opening its doors to new arrivals. Hotels in Skaltubo recently started offering free rooms to families fleeing Ukraine. As one generation displaced by war finally moves on to permanent housing, now a new generation seeks refuge here. For The World, I'm Levi Bridges in Skaltubo, Georgia.
Across Europe, authorities are warning of a disturbing trend. Women in nightclubs are being drugged. Typically, the aggressor slips a chemical into someone's drink. The crime is not new, but there's an alarming version of it happening now called needle spiking. Jerry Haddon reports from Bordeaux, France.
Needle spiking is jabbing someone with a syringe. The culprits usually slip away before the victims even know what hit them. Their targets are mostly women. In southwest France, just about every young woman you talk to seems to know someone who's been spiked, and it doesn't take long to meet a victim.
My name is Romane Lafraise, and I'm 17 years old.
Romane's at home on a recent day with her mom. She's not going out like she used to. In June, she went out dancing with friends to celebrate graduating high school.
I didn't drink alcohol. I didn't take drugs. I was very, very clean.
But then, she says, her head suddenly went from clear to confused.
I was with one of my friends. I didn't feel good at all. It was very, very painful in my head. I just couldn't understand why.
Romane fainted, then got sick. Her friends got her home safely.
It was like, Mom, I need help. So she helped me to go to my room. And I changed in my pajamas. I see just a mark.
A mark caused, she believes, by a needle. Between her first and second ribs, left side. Her mom, Beatrice, saw it too.
Donc là, je l'ai trouvé très speed, avec les pupilles.
My daughter was so agitated, she says. Her pupils were dilated. I saw the mark. It was red and about 2 centimeters long, with a puncture wound at the center, she says.
J'ose imaginer ce qui aurait pu se passer si elle était...
I don't dare imagine what might have happened, she says, if my daughter had been alone or with some sicko. French police have registered some 300 cases of needle spiking, all since March. The UK saw its first cases in 2021. Belgium and Spain say it's on their radar, too. Yet no arrests have been made anywhere, police say, because catching the culprit is so difficult. In the meantime, doctors are struggling to understand just how needle spiking started and what exactly is going on. Can you really get drugs into someone without them noticing? You can buy both hyperthin needles and date rape drugs easily online. But another theory says it's just some sadistic mind game, with copycats joining in across the continent. All of this has young people and authorities on edge. This is a public service tweet from France's Interior Ministry. It says, do you think you've been drugged? Go to the police. Get a blood test right away. The police and most club owners here in Bordeaux can't or won't talk. But Lorenzo Moliari will. He's tall, gray-haired, covered in tattoos.
I'm a professional DJ since 30 years. I went all around the world, but I'm living in Bordeaux now and working in that club.
That club, Moliari asks us not to name. He worries even talking about needles and druggings will hurt business.
In our club, yeah, it happened one time, but there was no drug effect. The girls just felt something. I think it was in the shoulder.
Moliari has a unique vantage point above the dance floor. He says, sadly, ever since he started DJing, he's heard about men trying to drug women.
Everywhere, all around the world. It's like that since Studio 54 in New York. In New York, in 1978, 79, you know.
Even modern clubs like Moliari's, with high security and lots of cameras, can't always stop it. So Molinari has his own public service announcement.
Take care with who you are going out, with who you are drinking, with who you are, you know.
But that's not always easy. At one of Barcelona's largest discos, Razzmatazz, some 3,000 young people are grooving on various dance floors. There's always someone who gets too drunk or too high, says head of security Jaime Ginesta. Ginesta says if we see a guy leaving with a girl who looks messed up, we take photos of their IDs. We can't stop someone leaving the club, he says, but at least we have a record should something go awry. For Bordeaux High School grad Romain Lafraise, it's all just so tragic. Besides feeling spooked at clubs, she's undergoing tests for HIV. She has no idea if the syringe she got spiked with was new or used. As for any advice she might have for fellow teens...
I don't want to give advice because we are young. We just have the right to have fun and to make party.
But Romain does have a message for the needle spikers themselves. Just stop. For The World, I'm Sherry Haddon, Bordeaux, France.
Get the news headlines dropped straight into your inbox every morning with our Top of the World newsletter. Our digital editors curate the three top stories of the day, together with some items you might have missed on the show. Subscribe to it if you haven't already at theworld.org. Between the war in Ukraine, climate change, and COVID, it is a mad, mad, madman world out there. But even through the madness, pop music from South Korea, K-pop, and its legions of fans are not waiting for the good time bell to ring. It's true, boy band heartthrobs BTS shocked their so-called army when they announced they were hitting pause on live shows. But don't fear, one of the members of the all-girl group, Twice, has gone solo and has done something no other K-pop soloist has, debuted in the top 10 on Billboard's 200 album chart. Neon released her self-titled EP this week. Anticipation was so high among her fans that it went straight to number 7. If you need any more superlatives, she also took the number 1 spot on Billboard World Albums Chart and Top Album Sales Chart. Now, as I said, this is Neon's first solo outing, so to frame herself outside of her other gig with her band Twice, Neon titled her EP Im Neon. It's a play on words. You can read it as I'm Neon, reintroducing herself to new fans. It's also a riff on her full name, Lim Neon. Either way, the EP is pure K-pop. Even the single of hers is simply called Pop. Pop, 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 and more pop. K-pop and singer Neon staying seriously on brand there. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.